Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The top Sikh leader calls marriage equality sick, L.A. queers offer shelter to SpongeBob, and the real story of Tchaikovsky's passionately gay pathetic. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sydney Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 22, 2005. The top clergy member of the Sikh religion this week issued a first-of-its-kind formal edict prohibiting celebration of same-gender marriages in Gurdwara anywhere in the world. The Jathedar of the Akal Takht in the Indian city of Amritsar, Johnny Joginder Singh Vedanti, said the very idea of those marriages was the product of sick minds and that they violate the Sikh code of conduct. He called on Sikhs to act to stop the spread of validation for gay and lesbian couples, a trend he described as anti-human tendencies. The Jathedar released his edict just 2 days before the arrival in India of Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada, a nation with both a substantial Sikh population and growing marriage equality. Martin had come in large part to discuss tsunami relief efforts with Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, but reporters demanded his response to the marriage issue. At first he responded, "This is a question of civil marriage, not of religious marriage. I would point out that we are a country of ethnic and religious minorities, and the purpose of the Charter of Rights is to protect minorities, to protect them against the oppression of the majority."
Martin's Liberal Party, which plans to introduce marriage equality legislation in the Canadian Parliament in February, actively courts Sikh support, and its four Sikh members of Parliament traveled with Martin. They and two other Sikh-Canadian MPs are split on the bill, which the Sikh leadership strongly urged them to oppose. Martin's marriage headaches this week did not end there. Leader of the opposition Conservative Party, Stephen Harper, announced a full-scale campaign, including newspaper ads, to contrast their support of traditional marriage with the ruling Liberals' support of marriage equality. Although Martin's support of opening marriage to gays and lesbians had previously seemed rather lukewarm, he responded strongly to the Conservative challenge. He said, "It's not my intention to go into an election. We want to govern. Am I ready to go into an election to uphold the Charter of Rights against those who would attack it? The answer is yes."
Two Russian gay men this week applied for a marriage license in Moscow, only to be turned away at the registry office. Officials cited the legal definition of marriage as between a man and a woman. The men were member of the Bashkortostan Parliament Edvard Murzin and Eduard Mishnin, the editor of Russia's only gay magazine, Kvir, and the website gay.ru. They're seeking to marry not because they're in love, they're not, but because they're activists trying to open legal marriage to same-gender couples. They believe a formal written rejection of their marriage application will serve as a basis for a lawsuit, one they said they'd take to the European Court of Human Rights if necessary. But there may be a price to pay. The day after the rejection at Wedding Palace No. 4, police visited the gay.ru office. They determined it was an improper use of the building and ordered the website to vacate within a week.
But in Brazil, a federal prosecutor this week filed for a federal judicial order that would require all Brazilian courts to perform same-gender marriages. João Gilberto Gonçalves Jr. told the Associated Press that he hoped both to gain legal rights for gay and lesbian couples and to help reduce prejudice and violence against them. Although the Brazilian Constitution defines marriage as between a man and a woman, Gonçalves believes it does not prohibit marriages to same-gender couples.
The U.S. law allowing one state to deny recognition to another state's same-gender marriages this week survived its first direct legal challenge to reach a federal court decision. The 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, could not truly be tested until some state actually performed gay and lesbian marriages, as Massachusetts began to do last year. The plaintiffs were Metropolitan Community Church Minister Nancy Wilson and Paula Schoenweather, a lesbian couple of 27 years standing, who married in Massachusetts but are explicitly denied legal standing as a couple in their Florida home. Their attorney, Ellis Rubin, who's also pursuing two more similar lawsuits apart from any of the major lesbo-gay legal groups, claimed DOMA unconstitutionally discriminates and violates basic rights. But U.S. District Judge James Moody denied there was precedent for him to declare marriage to be a fundamental right and upheld the contention of the U.S. Attorney General's office that procreation and child-rearing support a legitimate government interest in restricting marriage to heterosexual couples. Moody denied DOMA discriminates on the basis of sex, since men and women are equally restricted to marriage with the other gender. This case did not deal with the lesser-known but perhaps more discriminatory second section of DOMA, which bars the federal government from extending any recognition to same-gender couples, including a wide range of benefits.
While conservatives cheered that win for DOMA, it might help to stall their movement to amend the U.S. Constitution to restrict legal marriage to one man and one woman. Republican President George W. Bush told the Washington Post in an interview published this week that, at least in the U.S. Senate, the federal marriage amendment has no chance of passage until DOMA has been struck down by the courts. The religious right groups that had demanded and won Bush's vocal support for the FMA and responded by turning out voters for him feared this meant he was dropping the issue. The administration hurried to reassure them, promising the president would continue to advocate the need for the amendment.
Louisiana voters chose in September to amend their state constitution to define marriage exclusively as between one man and one woman. And this week, the Louisiana State Supreme Court unanimously reinstated that amendment. Previously, a state judge had struck down the amendment for having more than one topic, which the Louisiana Constitution prohibits, since, along with marriage, it bans recognition of a legal status identical or substantially similar to that of marriage for unmarried individuals. But the state's high court found the stated goal of defending marriage to be a single purpose, with each of its provisions serving that objective. Yet there was some good news for same-gender couples in this decision, as the justices declared the amendment will not affect any unmarried couple's ability to jointly own property, to contract powers of attorney with each other, or to make wills in each other's favor.
Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich this week signed into law the addition of sexual orientation as a category protected from discrimination in employment, housing, and credit under the state's Human Rights Act. Illinois becomes the 15th U.S. state to legislate equal treatment for lesbi-gays and the 5th to explicitly include transgenders.
And finally,
who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
In the biggest hoopla in the U.S. culture wars since TV preacher Jerry Falwell's group outed Teletubby Tinky Winky, the religious right is claiming that cartoon character SpongeBob SquarePants is brainwashing children into believing that gay is okay. Indeed, SpongeBob is one of over 100 campaigners for respect for diversity, including such suspected queers as Barney the Dinosaur, Bob the Builder, Winnie the Pooh, and some Muppets. They all appear in a music video of the song We Are Family. More than 60,000 of those tapes are planned to be sent to primary schools in March.
James Dobson, head of the Focus on the Family media empire, spotlighted what he called a pro-homosexual video this week in a speech to a Bush pre-inaugural dinner party of conservatives, including a number of Congress members. But it was the American Family Association's Ed Vitaliano who went beyond the video, which makes no reference whatever to sexuality, to the website of its makers, the nonprofit We Are Family Foundation. There appears the text of the Southern Poverty Law Center's pledge to respect differences, including differences in what it calls sexual identity, along with abilities, beliefs, cultures, and race. Vitaliano wrote of the video, "A short step beneath the surface reveals that one of the differences being celebrated is homosexuality."
Nile Rodgers, who co-wrote the 1979 disco classic, set up his foundation and produced the video in response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. His hope was to promote healing by teaching children about multiculturalism. He did intend the video to promote the tolerance pledge and even consulted with his foundation's personnel about possibly removing sexual identity from it. Their consensus was to retain it. But Rogers is bewildered by the religious right reaction, and he told the Associated Press, "Nothing could be more devastating to the people who believe in me and our organization than to imply there's an insidious undercurrent to it." His foundation's attorney bluntly told the New York Times that those attacking the video need medication.
The Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center seized the media moment to remind the public in a lighthearted way of the serious problems of lesbi-gay youth. Center head Lori Jean said in part, "If SpongeBob is gay, we want him to know he's not alone. The LA Gay and Lesbian Center's Youth Center and Transitional Living Program can offer him support and a home if he's ever kicked out of his pineapple under the sea or attacked because of his sexual orientation. We also invite SpongeBob to join the center's recently formed Gay Straight Alliance of cartoon characters that includes Bugs Bunny, Tinky Winky, Waylon Smithers, and Batman and Robin."
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 22, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
British schools will be encouraged to teach students about the achievements of lesbians and gay men around the world in February as part of a first-ever Gay History Month, which the government's Equality Minister, Jackie Smith, says is aimed at creating a more inclusive society. As This Way Out's contribution to that effort, we offer the following analysis of gay composer Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, The Pathetique, from a perspective you almost certainly didn't get in any music appreciation class. It's based on what historian and Slavic languages professor Simon Karlinsky told Christopher Street magazine in the late 1980s. From producer Hugh Young and narrator Barry Empson, here's Beyond the Sugar Plum Fairy.
Tchaikovsky publicly called the symphony, generally regarded as his greatest, the keystone of my entire oeuvre. Soon after he started writing it, he said its program was deeply subjective and would remain an enigma to all. Without exaggeration, I have put my entire soul into this symphony. 9 days after its first performance in 1893, Tchaikovsky was dead. It's well known that Pyotr Ilyich's brother Modest, also gay, suggested the title Pateticheskaya for his last symphony, rather than Programnaya, which would have made people ask what the program was. But Pateticheskaya does not mean pathetic in Russian. It means enthusiastic or passionate. The lineage of this story is rather long, but it is complete. In the 1940s, Karlinsky had a friend called Alex, who had spent several months with the painter Pavel Chelyshchov. Chelyshchov, in turn, had designed scenery and costumes in the 1920s for Sergei Diaghilev. And in his youth, Diaghilev was a friend of Modest Tchaikovsky. According to Simon, quoting Alex, quoting Pavel, quoting Sergei, quoting Modest, quoting Pyotr Ilyich himself, "The program of the Sixth Symphony is a celebration of gay sexuality, and the one who helped Tchaikovsky to celebrate it was his servant Alexei Sofronov, known as Alyosha." The murky bassoon and viola music shows half-conscious stirrings of the attraction to other men. Section is a feverish search within oneself and in the external world for ways to express this attraction. This expressive melody portrays the feeling of loving and being loved by the man of one's choice. The theme comprises all the notes of the D major scale, except for the leading note, C sharp, so that although it's authentic love music, it's incapable of its usual resolution into, say, a marriage, as the more conventional forms of love can be. Next, it is furiously pounced upon by the brutal rhythms of what we may call the homophobia theme. The theme of the feverish search scurries frantically, trying to escape or to hide from this incomprehension and hostility. Everything seems lost. During a brief lull in this raging orchestral storm, the low brass intones a portion of the Russian Orthodox funeral canticle, "May their souls rest with the saints." The search theme doesn't give up. And with the arrival of a prolonged low pedal tone in the basses and timpani, it finds a safe haven. Safe environment in which they can finally achieve the physical union they crave. In the middle range, the brief, penetrating phrases of the trombones of the tuba represent the beginning of the sex act itself. Scale, the key of the earlier love music, is the happiness and gratitude the two lovers feel as they obtain what they so desperately need. this time, the scale does have the leading note. But because it's descending, there is still no conventional resolution. The climax of the sexual act isn't shown. Instead of a climax, Tchaikovsky transfigures the love music by changing the key and placing it in a new harmonic and instrumental environment, which suggests that their love continues after lovemaking is over. Gentle, sighing coda concludes this encounter between two men who have succeeded in escaping from the disapproval and anger of the outside world. There were more explanations about the program of the rest of the symphony, but Karlinsky, unfortunately, can't remember them. Not the stumbling waltz in 5/4 time, though it's pleasant to guess that Tchaikovsky was saying that our dance of life has something extra rather than something missing. And its unconventional rhythm is more interesting than the conventional 3/4. Nor can Karlinsky remember the program for the Mischievous March. It's one of the most unmilitary marches ever written. Could Tchaikovsky have written it in praise of the non-macho man? Karlinsky does remember that the finale of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony was meant as a requiem for a friend and former lover who had died. Been a number of men. Edouard, whose death the composer mourns in one of his diaries. Ivan Veronovsky, an army officer who had an affair with Tchaikovsky in the Caucasus. To Tchaikovsky's horror, Ivan shot himself after he refused to make the relationship permanent. Or Alexei Apukhtin, who died about the time the symphony was composed. Tchaikovsky's gay nephew, Vladimir Davidov, known as Bob. Tchaikovsky had been in love with Bob since the nephew was a teenager, and Karlinsky guesses, by 1893, Bob returned his uncle's love. So the symphony could be a confession of his past loves to Bob, who was the first to learn that it had a private, intimate program. And he told Bob that he loved the passionate symphony more than any other of his musical offspring. And so do most listeners who go beyond the Sugar Plum Fairy. Our examples are played by the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Yevgeny Mravinsky. This program was written and produced by Hugh Young.
It's presented by Barry Empson. Technical production by Jerem Cvetanovich.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Rex Wachner, and Hugh Young and Barry Empson contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. It's you, our listeners, who keep this program on the air. And you can get some queer history and top music and movie reviews on specially produced audio CDs as a bonus. And to be sure you don't miss a week of This Way Out, you can subscribe to high-quality audio cassettes of our program. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KRFC Fort Collins, Colorado, 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, WSMU North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.